have a collect call from...
Mumia Jamal.
An inmate at the State Correctional Institution at Green...
Mumia Abu-Jamal is one of the lost souls of the revolution.
Mumia, how are you dealing with all of this darkness and despair and despondency and so forth? He said, let me write about it. I'll tell the truth about it. It's a living hell. It's a nightmare.
They have contained his body, and they're trying to figure out how to shut him down entirely.
They have moved heaven and earth to stop his voice being heard in the United States.
I know a lot of political prisoners, and Mumia is locked down as hard as anyone I've ever met. But I've also never met anybody that has such a warmth and such a sense of humor and such a perspective on the world.
Mumia Abu-Jamal is a revolutionary person. So he's like a guerrilla in the jungle, in a tent in the rain, writing to the community with next to nothing.
You come through at a time that your technology was there, that could go around the world. And one day we will find out that he was the voice of America. The voice of America is a fraud.
When you're pushing the lie, the truth is very threatening.
Powerful governments like to control. They love to control. And they love to silence people. They cannot silence Mumia.
And he's somebody who the state of Pennsylvania thinks needs to die.
We would not be who we are as African Americans of this day were it not for the Reverend, the prophet, Nat Turner, who brilliantly merged the religious and the political, who didn't just talk about the world to come, but fought to transform the world that is.
You are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, and we were paying tribute to, or we have paid tribute to, Barry White, who was born in Galveston, Texas, but he considered himself an Angeleno. And joining me on the line is Patrice Cullors, who is the founder and lead organizer of an organization called the Coalition to End Sheriff Violence in Los Angeles Jails. And the Coalition to End Sheriff Violence in L.A. Jails is a grassroots, multiracial organization bringing together community organizations, health providers, clergy, attorneys, community, residents, friends, and families, and survivors of the brutality inside L.A. jails to fight for real accountability. And how are you doing, Ms. Cullors?
I'm doing really great. I actually just came back from organizing outside of the Linwood County jails here in Los Angeles. It's the women's jail. So it was an important day of organizing, a lot of hard stories, but I'm glad that I'm doing the work.
Let me ask you this. We hear a lot of talk about the LAPD, the police department. What is the difference between the LA Police Department and the Sheriff's Department for people outside of Los Angeles? Is there a difference, or are they the same?
They're a different law enforcement agency. LAPD are in charge of just LA City, and LA Sheriff's Department. The Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department is in charge of the entire county, which is 10 million people. So they are their jurisdiction is all the community colleges. They're in charge of the 8 facilities, the county jails. They're also in charge of the unincorporated cities like East LA or Linwood inside Los Angeles. And they're contracted to different cities throughout Los Angeles County, like Beverly Hills and Pacific Palisades.
All right, let me ask you this. I left Los Angeles many, many years ago, and I came back. And when I left Los Angeles, we were basically, the African community was couldn't go past Broadway at one point, and we were basically confined to, you know, a lot of people went to Jefferson High School, a lot of people went to Jordan High School, then eventually they went to Fremont, all of those on the east side. But now the African community is, black people are on in Orange County, all over. How has that affected the organizing, you as an organizer? I get you don't remember when, I guess you're too young to remember that far back, but isn't it harder to organize now because the black folks are so spread out?
It's definitely difficult. And I do remember, as I'm 29 years old. I have four generations here in Los Angeles. My great grandmother migrated here from Oklahoma, and she came here, and my great-grandfather was able to get a house from the GI Bill. They built their life in South Central and then moved over to Pacoima in the San Fernando Valley. And so I grew up with a significant amount of black people in the last, you know, the first kind of 10 years of my life. In the last 15, I would say, you know, black people started moving to Palmdale. Black people started moving to the Inland Empire. They started moving to Vegas. So I thought my mother would never leave Vegas. I mean, never leave the Valley. And she now lives in Vegas, in Las Vegas, Nevada, because of how the price to live in Los Angeles. But really, to be honest with you, Norm, the reason why my mom left is because of the amount of policing here in Los Angeles, and right, just feeling like our family was being hunted. And so she made that choice, and so it is difficult because there is a diminishing black population here in Los Angeles, but I think it's still an extremely important organizing tool to have those conversations with the black people who are still here and saying, do you notice black folks leaving and where are they going? And our coalition actually took a tour of the Los Angeles County jails, and one of my friends who just moved here from Philadelphia looked over at me and said, this is where all the black people are. They're here in the county jails. So I think that's also a big piece of it that we're trying to make the link. It's like black people are being pushed out both to other cities, other counties, other states, but they're also being pushed directly into prison, you know, heavily policed communities. Both black folks are in the county jail system.
Let me say, I don't want to cut you, but this is another thing that I've noticed, and it really disturbs me to go to Skid Row and to see the number of African people on Skid Row. We seem to be in the vanguard of Skid Row as well.
Yeah, that's very true. I think there were two reports done by professors at USC, black women professors at USC and Occidental, and the reports were talking about black folks and the homicide rate, black folks and homelessness, black folks and mortality rate, and every single statistic, we were at the bottom. I mean, we were the first, you know, leading in homelessness, leading in early deaths, leading in, you know, incarceration, leading in school pushout. So I think that our reality is pretty grim, and we need movements and campaigns that are actually looking at issues we face dead on, you know, looking at and having strong and powerful demands that say we won't allow this to happen to our communities anymore, and we have to take on something like the sheriff's department. I think a lot of folks say, you know, that's a hefty crew of people to be taking on, but if we don't do it, then who's going to? And us as black people, we are bearing the brunt of you know, the racism and the violence inside those jails and on the streets. So if we don't stand up against the folks that are kicking our behinds literally, then who is going to?
You're listening to Diaspora Music on Uhuru Radio. I'm speaking with Patrice Cullors, and I basically wanted, you are the founder and lead organizer of the coalition. Could you give me when you started the organization, and just give me, you know, some history of the group and why it started?
Yes. I am Patrice Cullors, founder and lead organizer of the Coalition to End Shared Violence in LA Jails, founded on August 3rd of 2012. A lot of it was in response to the Citizens Commission on Jail Violence that was produced and created by the County Board of Supervisors, Supervisor Mark Libby Thomas and Supervisor Xavier Slavsky here in Los Angeles, both created a motion that asked the County Board of Supervisors to develop a year-long study, a commission that could do a year-long study, an investigation of the Sheriff's Department. I found out about that study in August, but what I did before that is, in true fashion of an artist, because I'm both an artist and community organizer, I created an art piece out of the 86-page complaint that the ACLU started against the Sheriff's Department and the 70 sworn statements that the ACLU collected from inmates inside the county jails about their stories of violence against them, you know, stories that detailed broken bones, fractured jaws, stories that detailed some inmates having things carved into their bodies. And the reason why it's personal, it hits home for me, because my brother was incarcerated inside the Los Angeles County jails. And when he was incarcerated in those jails, he was beaten so badly that he blacked out. When he awoke, he was in a pool of his own blood. He thought he was going to die inside those jails. And he was handcuffed to his bedpost. He was left without a blanket, without a cot to sleep on. And all intents and purposes, he was tortured inside those jails. My mother was unable to visit him. They kept telling her that he was on lockdown. When she eventually did see him, he was drugged up on psychotropic drugs and he was emaciated. My mother called the ACLU over and over again to come see him, check up on him. And so I used my family story, because my mother documented everything. I used my family story and I used the ACLU document. And then I have four live performers enact how it is to be inside the LA County jails. It's a performance art piece, and it was on tour all of last year. It's going back on tour this summer. But then I took it a step further. By June, I understood that we needed to have some sort of movement, large movement against shared violence. No one else was doing it. No one else was talking about it in the grassroots level. And so I took it on myself, talked to a few colleagues, asked if they would help support me in this process, and I started a coalition, and we've made leaps and bounds. We've gotten the attention of Supervisor Mark Ridley Thomas's office. He has endorsed the coalition. He wants to also see civilian oversight over the Sheriff's Department. We've held many press events. LA Times has covered us. CBS News has covered us. Different Spanish news television stations, KPFK Radio. So all of Los Angeles and many parts of the country have heard the coalition's cry for an independent civilian review board that is wholly made up of citizens that can have subpoena power and the ability to change the practices and policies inside the Sheriff's Department. That's our single demand. And our hope is that we will be in this work until we see that civilian review board put into action.
Okay, now, this is a question that maybe you can answer. It's kind of a difficult question. Now, when I left Los Angeles many moons ago, you know, like I say, the community was, I didn't really realize that, you know, the African community was, we were as small as we were in terms of the numbers, but now we are even smaller. The African community, or the black people in Los Angeles, migrated, many of them migrated from Louisiana, Texas, Oklahoma, to a lesser degree, Mississippi. Now we have a lot of people coming in from Belize. Could you break down, you know, like the Latino communities? Because I know we have the Chicanos as well as people from Mexico, Guatemala, so on and so forth, and the Asians. You know, could you give me a breakdown of what makes up Los Angeles in 2013?
That's a good question.
You might not be able to answer.
I know what makes up the jails, but I don't have the numbers for Los Angeles County as a whole. The reality is that its majority, definitely there is a large majority of Latino community. I think that black folks, we make up 6% of Los Angeles County. But I don't really know the other numbers that make up Los Angeles County in that way.
Right. Because I know a lot of, you know, the Latinos are El Salvador, Guatemala, and the Latino community is not hegemonious in terms of, it's a lot of people from different countries. It's which I guess would be make it difficult for them to organize as a group as well.
Right. Right. Yeah, I mean, around this issue in particular, though, that folks, you know, I have a member who's from Honduras, and she said that in her country she did a lot of work around human rights abuses, and she, in her mind, you know, she thought that the U.S. was great. She was really, I would say, you know, brainwashed to think that the U.S. was this amazing country, and she came over. And now she says, you know, the sheriff locked her son up. They came in her house. They put a gun up to her head. They left her other son in the car for hours in the heat. He suffered kidney. He already had bad kidneys. He suffered further kidney damage from that experience. And she says at every meeting, you know, this country's a lie. And so there's this kind of, with this group of people that we're organizing, the people that have been, I mean, literally, you know, violated by the sheriff's department, there's a kind of level of unity amongst the folks around, especially black and Latino people, that we need to come together in order to beat this back.
Let me ask you, since I've been here, I think that the Los Angeles Times, I'm not impressed with the Los Angeles Times at all. When Stevie Wonder was going to do his benefit for the Israeli army, they never covered the fact that he was going to do it, or the fact that he backed down, or I shouldn't say backed down, he was persuaded not to go. And then Chaka Khan did her thing. She did it anyway, but that wasn't covered in the Los Angeles Times, and the Los Angeles Times never even bothered to the way they reported the incident in Compton. They are basically, it seems as if they are trying to create more friction between the black and brown community, because it's my understanding that the conflict that's really taking place in Compton is a drug situation. It's not necessarily between the African people and the Latinos. It's between drug dealers on both sides. But the way the Los Angeles Times are portraying it, it's basically, you know, brown people don't want black people to live in Compton anymore, and it's
they're simplifying the matter.
Completely correct what they're saying. Could you talk about that?
Do you want me to specifically talk about the issues around drug sale and the drug cartel here in Los Angeles, or the issues of black and brown communities specifically in Compton?
In Compton.
Yeah, I think there's something that's, you know, this is a really important conversation to have around black and brown issues here on the outside, and black and brown violence that has a lot to do with what happens inside U.S. jails and prisons. A lot of hierarchy that exists on the inside that many of us don't know about, specifically amongst specifically the Mexican community. It's not just the kind of Latino blanket community, it's the Mexican community, and the role that they play inside the jails. And I don't want to speak too much to it because it's a little dangerous, but there is they have a lot of power, and that power gets translated into the streets. And what it translates into is black and brown violence, because that's true, but I think what you're pointing out is there's something deeper happening, which is specifically around the drug trade, the drug cartels, specifically around money laundering and things like that. So with then what it gets spun as this issue between black and brown people, when in reality it's a deeper issue around what's happening inside and who's doing the shot calling inside U.S. jails and prison, and then who's the messenger on the outside. And unfortunately,
right.
You know, our people become the puppeteers of that much bigger system.
Mm-hmm. Because like the Los Angeles Times, they seem to be trying to really simplify it to, it's almost like they're agitating. They would like to see, to spread the conflict between the various peoples. I guess what it's, you and I are students of society, and it's in the interest of the system to keep people fighting one another.
Yeah, I don't know if the Los Angeles Times is doing it on purpose. I would hope not. But I think there's a lot of ignorance in, you know, these media outlets with people just having never lived inside these communities, don't really know about what goes on, and so they see this thing that looks like black and brown violence, and then they want to trump it up to that versus, well, what's really happening? What are the real issues? What are the root causes that are creating this, you know, dynamic, instead of this just being some, like, exciting news story to get people, you know, riled up about, like, what are the real issues? And I think that is a larger conversation for mainstream media that they often don't document on the true nature of what's happening inside our communities.
All right, I wanted to shift gears. I believe you, when I met you, you said you were going to the Pan-African Film Festival. And I went to the Pan-African Film Festival, and I saw a couple of great films. One was on called 1802, about slave rebellion, the slave rebellions in Guadeloupe. And then I saw the great film about the Maroons in Jamaica, which was done by a young man who used to live in Toronto. And I saw the panel that they had on Django, and now we have the Mumia film. I know you're going to have something to do with the Mumia film. Did you go to the Pan African Film Festival, and did you see any of those films from Guadeloupe or Tusta? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I actually went and saw War Witch. I've been going to the Pan African Film Festival for, well, the last 13 years. This year I decided to, I really wanted to look at different type of films, so I went and saw War, which was a movie about the Congo and a young woman who was stolen from her village, and then her, what she believes and what the village believes, her kind of inner intuition and sorcery was enacted, and she was able to escape bondage and had a child, and it was a really powerful movie, but spoke more directly to the issues of child soldiers inside the Congo and the U.S.'s mm-hmm. role and building up an environment that would make people want to fight over, you know, raw materials that we use for our cell phones and computers.
Right. Also, you didn't see Guadeloupe or Haiti or Tucson with your film, but first of all, before we go, I would like to thank Lisa Watkins for doing the technical work on the show today. And basically, you can whatever you wanted to end with, you can end with. We have about 7 minutes, but I guess you wanted to talk about the fact that your organization has something to do with the Mumia, which is correct.
Yes. I mean, there's two things I would want to leave this show talking about, which is the new Mumia documentary, Long Distance Revolutionary. And we are having a launch party at the SAGE office this Wednesday from 7 to 9 p.m. And the office is 152 West 32nd Street, Los Angeles, California. And the zip code is 90007. That's 152 West 32nd Street, Los Angeles, California, 90007. It's a free event. You can also get pre-sale tickets at the event for the movie. And I think that it's just a really important film for all of us that are in this struggle to free our folks from bondage, to really look at Mumia's story as, he's been a huge contributor in journalism and critiquing this country's role in really heinous acts against Black people in particular. So I really want to make sure that we come out, and this launch party is going to have poets and spoken word artists and speakers from the Coalition to End Share Violence in LA Jails, a mother, Sandra Neal, who's telling her story about her son and her family story and why people should join organizations and fight back. And then the last thing I would want to invite people to is to, we are having a town hall, a South LA town hall here in Los Angeles, to speak directly to our demand for civilian oversight over the Sheriff's Department. And the town hall is on March 14th. The address is 1006 East 28th Street, Los Angeles, California, 90011. We are having a town hall, which there will be speakers. There will also be performances at the town hall, students who are going to speak about the impacts of sheriff violence in their community. And we think that Supervisor Mark Willie Thomas' office will be in attendance. So this is super, super important to us.
You have about 4 minutes. You can go on if you wish.
That's great. I think what else is important about the Coalition to End Sheriff Violence in LA Jails is here in Los Angeles, there's been so much talk about LAPD in the last 20 years since the Rodney King beating. When that was caught on tape in Lakeview Terrace, there was so much talk and so much scrutiny, whereas the LA Sheriff's Department didn't have very much scrutiny at all, and they were beating up people inside LA County jails and shooting people in the back here in Los Angeles, and a lot of folks in Compton and throughout their jurisdiction. And I think that this conversation to hold the Sheriff's Department accountable is one of the most significant conversations here in Los Angeles, and I think it has huge implications across the country if we are able to really develop some policy and practices that make them be transparent and accountable, because we know that when things change in Los Angeles, people follow suit and change. It changes in the rest of the country. So just that when we launch this, I think the campaign on March 14th, this town hall is going to be huge, because we are also launching a national letter that we're asking coalitions and organizations and people, including radio stations like this, Uhuru Radio, and folks like you, Norman, to sign on to this letter that speaks directly to urging the County Board of Supervisors to implement a civilian review board. So I think that's kind of the up and coming, how the rest of the world, the rest of the country can donate their time towards this coalition.
All right. I'd like to thank you, and we would definitely like to stay in contact with you. And I will see you Wednesday. And we met through a mutual friend of ours. I know he's not into publicity, so I won't even mention his name, but I'll say he's a great filmmaker from this area. And I did go to high school with him, but he is not a Madonna or Spike Lee. He's not a publicist. He can walk away from a microphone. And I'd like to thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Norman. I really appreciate it. Have a good rest of your day.
All right. Thank you. And take care. We have been speaking with Patrice Cullors. Another dope style by the massive VDP Pro. Of course, I will now present to you a different view. The 1990s. Of course, 89 is behind me. So check it out. It's called breath control, style. Breath control, the love. Breath control, the love. Breath control, style. Breath control, the love. KRS-One, yes, the teacher. I wear Clarks and Holy Night sneaker. In your sneaker is the new style. A
child in the front row or behind me. We're gonna pull somebody far for the 90s. You want lyrics? We come correct. BTP, only moving with respect. The other MCs, they can't believe me. Or when I rhyme, it sounds just like a CD. We don't lip sync, we go all live. On stage, I bring about four or five. That's DD, Nice, Cindy, and Melody. Or myself, Harmony, and Willie D. We come humble, we just rumble. While other MCs crew just crumble. They want dances, they want lighting. They want effects to make them look exciting. But it's frightening, cause without that, the whole crew is whack. BDP comes with the cheapest and perform miracles like Jesus. The total respect, we achieve it. And the big headliner can't believe it. It's called breath control, breath control, breath control, slightly. Breath control, the low. Breath control, the low. Breath control, breath control, breath control, slightly. Breath control, the low. Get ready for the break.
Quabba, this is Norman Otis Richmond speaking to you from Southern California, and we have been listening to some blues music. We heard KRS-One. Joining me on the line is the producer-director of a film called A Quabba, A Journey, and this is a film about the Maroons of Jamaica, and it won the Best Featured Documentary in the 2012 Belize International Film Festival. It screened yesterday at the Pan-African Film Festival, and I would like to welcome Roy T. Anderson to Uhuru Radio. How are you doing today, my good friend?
I'm doing real good. Thanks for having me. If I can make a quick correction, the title is A Quantu, The Journey, if you don't mind.
A Quantu. Okay.
Yes.
Someone told me. I'm thinking about a Quatu in Toronto.
Right.
A Quantu.
That's correct.
That is Twi.
That's right, for the journey.
Okay. Twi. All right. So thank you for that correction. I guess the first question I want to ask you is why the film?
Why the film?
Yes, sir.
I asked myself too, but... It wasn't really something that I had planned on doing. It just basically it just developed, and at some point, you know, I just couldn't control it. I have a curious mind, so from time to time, I would go to family members and wanted to know more about my family history, and I wasn't happy with the information I was getting, so I decided to just dig a little bit deeper. And as I dug deeper and uncovered information about my family, Maroons, the word Maroons just kept on coming up in my research. And I remember many years back, my grandfather always talked about that, you know, we had people who come from up in the hills, and he met the Maroons, you know, up in the hills in Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided that, I mean, this is no accident. After that, I grabbed as many as I could on the Maroons, read as many articles and things, and even still, I just wasn't satisfied, but decided that, you know what, you know, people, anthropologists, scholars and stuff, you know, they've studied the Maroons at length. But I felt that to really do justice to what they were able to achieve, you know, the Maroons, my ancestors, they deserved a big screen treatment. And myself being in the industry, the film industry, for over 30 years, I felt that it was, you know, a natural thing for me to do. And that's why I decided to do a Quantum of the Journey.
Now, who funded A Quantu, The Journey?
You're speaking to him. 100% out of pocket. Labor of love.
I don't want to get too personal, but how much did the film cost? I mean, you know, you don't have to give me... I understand that's a personal question. So how...
Have you well, I will say this. You know, I have pulled out a lot of favors, and I owe people a lot of money that did work, and they signed deferral contracts. So if I added all that up, I would say the budget is in the neighborhood of over $300,000.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay, before we get into the meat of the film, I wanted to know, can you talk about the distribution? Now, you have won that prize in Belize, which is...
Yes.
Belize is in Central America. A lot of people
yes,
from
that's
Belize
correct.
Are.
Yes.
A lot of people from Belize are in Los Angeles, and the people of Belize are beginning to have a real serious impact in Los Angeles, California.
Yes.
And they are making their presence felt. I think I understand the people in Belize are many of them in Chicago. I don't understand how they can survive that cold
right.
in New York City. But can you talk about the distribution? Of A Quantu.
All right. Well. Right now, it's in the inception stage right now. The DVD hasn't been released, and what I set out to do in a very grassroots way, without any institutional support, was to get the film seen in as many places as possible. That can make a difference. And, you know, one of the platforms that I employed was to get it into certain festivals. So that's one.
Yes, sir.
A second platform is to get it into the universities. And the film has shown at universities such as Georgia State University, Boston University. I just recently showed last week at the University of Ghana in Lagos, and we've also showed it at the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute in Alabama. So and in Toronto at certain cinemas and things like that. So this was just one of the ways that I thought that I can you know, just build up a buzz, you know, build up awareness for the film, so that at the end of the day, this is something that I can take to a potential distributor. And show them that, you know, there is interest in a film like this, even if it's not quote unquote commercial fare, right?
Mm-hmm.
So as it is right now, I mean, there are one or two, there are several distributors that are interested. I don't want to say their name right now, but there's definite interest. And you know, this material is very important. So I'm going to just sit down with my co-producer and wife, Allison, and make the best decision in terms of going forward for the film. I'd like to have it released widely on DVD for educational and home use, and also love to get some broadcast deals as well, too.
So you have a PBS-type situation in the U.S. You have TV Ontario in Canada, you know, you have BBC and whatever the equivalent would be in Japan.
In the UK.
And UK, and I know, being a thinking man, you want to get your thing screened in China and India, of course.
Oh, absolutely. And especially, I think, especially in a country like Japan, I believe, you know, there's a hunger for Jamaican culture. I don't know if most people know that, you know. Go ahead and explain.
I
don't know if most people know, but I mean, there is quite a dancehall culture over there in Japan.
Yes, sir. Correct.
So they appreciate
very big, very big,
right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be important, you know, the distributor that I hook up with, to be able to maximize these market potentials.
All right, I'm speaking with Roy T. Anderson, the producer and director of Akwantu, The Journey. And now let's talk about the film. In a nutshell, give us what is the film about?
Well, the log line is what it is. It's a groundbreaking documentary on the history of the legendary Maroons of Jamaica and their gallant fight for freedom. That's what you would see in TV Guide. But quite simply, it starts out as a very personal journey, which is my journey as a vehicle. And the film morphs into a more significant history of the New World's first successful freedom fighters, which are my ancestors, the Maroons of Jamaica. So my journey is just interwoven throughout the film. You know, I see my journey as a subplot, but the main thrust of this film is the history, the epic history of the Maroons of Jamaica and what they were able to achieve, especially in the first Maroon War, which basically you're looking at a period from 1722 to 1738. Historians would refer to that as the First Maroon War, but that was predated by about maybe 60 years of ongoing struggle. So from the time the British invaded and took over Jamaica in 1655, you know, there was an ongoing conflict with these Africans in the hills, in the rugged terrain in Jamaica that lasted over 80 years. 80 years. They were not able to vanquish the Maroons, the British mm-hmm. superpower. And this is what this film celebrates.
And could you talk about, there were other Maroon communities in the New World, like...
Oh, absolutely. Go ahead.
No, I'm saying that. I'm looking at a piece on Palmares in Brazil. I mean, Maroon.
Absolutely,
Maroon,
yes.
I think Maroon is a term that applies to enslaved Africans that escaped, and I think in many parts of the New World. But the Maroons are the first out of the block, and I guess to a degree they were successful.
Yes. And I want to try and correct myself a little bit and other folks who may think that Maroons are only escaped enslaved Africans, because as a point of fact, I believe the first Maroons in Jamaica were the indigenous people. You know, these were the Taino Indians.
Yes. Right, correct, right.
They were the first Maroons,
mm-hmm.
right? So then, you know, wherever there was an institution of slavery, whether it was in the New World or in Africa, there was always that instances of revolts, resistance, rebellion, you name it, right? You mentioned Belize. You have the Garifunas in Belize. I mean, they made their stand in St. Vincent, I believe.
Right.
Right?
Same, yeah, I believe, yes.
And in Suriname, you have the Saramancas. You have the Quilombos, and I believe that's in Brazil.
Right.
So you have Maroon type societies all over the world, even in the U.S., for example. Right?
Florida.
You got the Black Seminoles. A lot of people don't know about their history. They're not celebrated, and they should be. Out of that came the Buffalo Cowboys. Everybody knows about the Buffalo Cowboys.
The Buffalo Soldiers, I think they're kind of, I don't know, Bob Marley did a song called The Buffalo Soldiers, but I don't know if the Buffalo Soldiers are something that we should be proud of as personal. That's just my take on it, because I think they're going to come on the wrong side of history, but we don't want to deal with that right now.
All right, let's stay away from that.
Right. But no, I wanted you to continue, because in terms of the Maroons specifically in Jamaica,
yes.
One of the contributions that they made was they were great tacticians in guerrilla warfare, and you kept.
Oh, they were fierce warriors. Fierce.
Beautifully in the film. Could you talk about that?
Well, I mean, a lot of people would look at something as simple as camouflage. You got the Green Beret, you got the Army Rangers, and I'm sure all these countries have similar soldiers. I mean, where do you think all that stuff came from? Right? You know, the Maroons mastered the art of camouflage. You had certain instances when the British were up against them, and the soldiers in their big, bright red and black uniforms, you know, would march up into the hills, and let's say for a moment they're tired, and they lean on what they think is a tree. In the next instance, I mean, they're enveloped by a Maroon warrior, right?
Right.
And you know, sometimes, I mean, this would really frighten them so much that it's written that some of these soldiers would commit suicide and jump to their death in a lot of these precipices. Up in the hills, right? So they were also taught to remain motionless while their enemy is around.
Right.
Doesn't matter if a mosquito or a fly pitch on them; they're motionless. And they were so smart too that they would rub the leaves on their body, so that even the bloodhounds that would try and track their scent would have a hard time to find them.
Right. You're dealing with a very skillful and intelligent set of people.
Well, I mean, people would look at it and they would say, "Oh, yeah, these are just a bunch of Africans." Up in the hills, you know, no design, you know, to their battle plan or so forth. But, you know, smart historians will tell you that there was a certain method to this so-called perceived madness. This was an intelligentsia at play of the highest degree, the highest degree.
Well, I wanted to ask you this now. There's a whole lot of talk about Django Unchained, Quentin Tarantino's film, and the difference in Django Unchained and A Quantu, The Journey, and I saw a film the other day called 1802 about a slave rebellion or a revolution in Guadeloupe, which took place 2 years before Haiti. 1802, and Haiti became free in 1804. In Tarantino's film, it was basically about a man fighting for his woman, or to be crude, his old lady, whereas the film that you did, A Quantu, The Journey, and that I saw on 1802 by Kristen Lara, it showed men and women fighting against their oppressors, and women were not only fighters, but they were also thinkers. Could you talk about the role of Nanny and Cujo, but Nanny in particular? She's one of the national heroes of Jamaica.
Well, I'm so glad that that you brought that up. Nanny was a fierce warrior, on par. I was going to say on par with all the female warriors. No, I mean she had no equal. She had no equal. The men revered her. the British soldiers, I mean, they were absolutely afraid of her. A brilliant tactician. Also, a herbalist. You know, what more can I say?
Now, Yah Asantewaa, you also went back to Ghana. You
yes, I did.
Talked to some descendants of Yah Asantewaa now.
Yes.
It's my understanding, and this might be a little off of track, but I wanted to raise it anyway. Yah Asantewaa was took over from a man by the name of Primpre, and Primpre, I understand, led the struggle, but he was exiled to Madagascar or the Seychelles,
yes.
And she, Yah Asantewaa, took over and led the struggle.
But yes.
This is just a little point of information. Wynton Kelly, the great pianist who was of Jamaican and Trinidadian heritage, his brother, who was a Jamaican, took the name Primpre, and he led the Marcus Garvey movement in New York for many, many, many years. Milton Kelly was his slave name.
Yes.
But I just wanted to throw that out there. But you went back and actually spoke to some of Yah Asantewaa's descendants. Could you talk about that?
Well, God rest her soul. Nana Trinoboa, that's Yah Asantewaa's granddaughter, is no longer with us. She passed several months ago. So, God bless her. The reason why I felt that it was important to talk to Nana Trinoboa was just to illustrate this tradition of a warrior woman in the Asante culture. Now, according to the oral tradition, Nanny is a queen, referred to as a queen of Ashanti stock, and that's why I felt it was important to go back there. And you know, as I said in the documentary, when I looked into the eyes of Nana Trinoboa, I really saw her grandmother, and I really saw, if I wasn't fortunate enough, you know, to meet Nanny, I saw in Trinoboa's eyes. I mean, I saw the fire in her eyes, and it reminded me of Nanny. Those Ashanti women are no joke. So I can just imagine, you know, back in the day when people was up against Nanny, what they had to deal with.
Right.
There was just, you know, I mean, there was power. And I see pride. And a lot of people don't know the story about Yah Asantewaa. She just basically stood up at a meeting one day and said, you know, if the men are not going to fight, then I'm going to take the women, and we're going to fight. So that war between the British colonizers and in the old Gold Coast, and I believe it was in 1898, was effectively called the Yah Asantewaa War.
Mm-hmm.
And she is herself a national heroine of today, what is Ghana, just like Nanny being a national hero in Jamaica.
Yes, correct. I have in my house in Toronto, I have a picture of the national heroes of Jamaica, and Nanny, I think, is the only woman national hero of Jamaica, correct?
That's right. And there is a movement afoot to try and get Kodjo named a national hero. And that hasn't had much traction. And I think I know why. I'm not sure if you want the answer.
I do want the answer.
All right. Well,
it might answer my next question.
All right. Well, as much as we celebrate, and I, you know, celebrate what the Maroons were able to achieve in their ongoing struggle with the British and with the militia and so forth, the history is quite complicated, and the signing of this blood treaty in 1738 is my case in point. You know, this ongoing struggle and war with the Maroons certainly put a crimp on the economics of the plantation system in Jamaica. you know, you had nonstop raids on the plantation and so forth. So, you know, at the time, you know, when this treaty was signed, that signaled peace. Raids on the plantation ceased and so forth. So some of the terms in this treaty, this blood treaty, was that the Maroons had to come to the aid, you know, for example, of the colonial, of the British, for example, if they were being invaded, right? And also to help them capture and return runaway slaves, right? In return for that, I'm not going to say that they were granted their freedom. They were able to maintain their freedom.
Which they fought for and won.
Right. The most important thing that came out of this was they were able to establish their own autonomy. Right? Mm-hmm. So because of this treaty, you know, there a lot of the Maroons' African brethren and sisters saw them as collaborators and traitors.
Mm-hmm.
And I can understand. And even today, people look at them as such.
Right. Well, that was going to be the next question I asked you, and you've already answered it, because it was Dr. John Hendricks Clark, who was a real student of both Marcus Mosiah Garvey and William Edward Burghardt Du Bois. In fact, you quote Du Bois in your film about the Atlantic, about the slave trade. But
that's,
you know,
right.
Dr. Clark,
most magnificent drama.
Dr. Clark maintained that every people, period, you know, produces revolutionaries, working class heroes, traitors, buffoons, and idiots.
Absolutely.
Know, that's everybody, and I think you are you're coming off of a position that's, you're not taking a chauvinistic position that the Maroons were the baddest and greatest and had no contradictions, because you just basically said there was, it's a complex question. And, you know, signing that treaty, I mean, some people write the Maroons off completely because of that.
Yes.
And I also, there's another thing I would like to ask you. I read in George Padmore's book, Pan-Africanism or Communism, but I read it a long time ago. He pointed out that Africans from North America who had fought on the side of the British were sent to Nova Scotia, and when they found out, you know, it's like, what the F is this? You know, they got, this is a bunch of rocks. We can't live here.
Right.
They went back to Sierra Leone, and also there was Maroons who were in from Sierra Leone, went to Sierra Leone that, you know, they couldn't control, I think, from Tawani Town. Is that the proper name?
In Sierra Leone?
No, in Jamaica.
Oh, Trelawney Town. That was, you know, as a result of the Second Maroon War.
Yeah. Okay. But the point I'm making is that the British used these Maroons to suppress the Africans who had come from Nova Scotia, and that's, you know, that's the point I'm making is that when I first moved to Toronto, I used to come in contact with a lot of Caribbean people, and they were always very critical of Africans in America because they had fought in the imperialist wars. And before, when I started to read history, I found out that all people had fought. You know, I mean, you know, there's some, most of us have supported the freedom of our people, but we've all had collaborators. That's the point I'm making. Yeah.
Yes. And
go ahead.
And you know, the thing is, once again, even with talking about what the Maroons were able to do with their guerrilla warfare, there was a method to that. And I think even with the signing of the treaty, I believe, you know, there was a method to what Kodjo was doing. Kodjo, you know, as the main signer of that treaty. And back to my point, I believe that's one of the main reasons why I don't believe he's a national hero in Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
Right? History is complicated. History is complicated. All people's history. But as I pointed out in the documentary, despite, I mean, where you are on this with the argument in terms of the Maroons, one thing one thing that you have to agree with is that had it not been for them, I can actually say that I'm not sure the Haitian Revolution would have happened when it did. I'm not sure if emancipation in Jamaica would have came when it did. I'm not sure if you would have had heroes like Nat Turner and Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman in the U.S. I'm sure they heard what happened, you know, in that small island in the Caribbean. And I'm sure it inspired those, you know, to further resist in the Americas.
There's no doubt about it, because I don't know. I'm not abracadabra hocus pocus, man, but people knew what was taking place. I mean, that's why the Haitian, if people knew so much about the Haitian Revolution, they had to know about the Maroons as well, you know.
Well, see, the thing is, I mean, that's what most historians, I mean, they glorify the Haitian Revolution, and not to knock what Toussaint Louverture was doing with his people in Haiti, he gave homage to the Maroons in Jamaica as inspiring the revolution. But historians are not talking about this. That's a big frustration on my part.
Beautifully in the film. We only have 2 minutes, and I wanted to give you these last 2 minutes to sum up in whatever you wanted to say.
Well, I got to tell you, a festival like the Pan African Film Festival, I really appreciate the opportunity to have a classroom setting. And, you know, I believe with my film I was able to educate and open some eyes. And I really got to tip my hat off to Babu and the rest of his crew there. And I thank him for that. I wasn't at the screening yesterday, but I understand the theater was pretty packed. Seats were hard to come by.
I was there yesterday.
Yes. So you can you can attest to that.
I can attest to that, right?
Yes. So, I got comments from folks afterwards. You know, they said they laughed. You know, they cried. You know, especially some Jamaicans that were in the crowd, you know, they were saying, this is history that I didn't know about. It brings me back to Jamaica. And some were sad because with this film, I pay homage to the oral tradition. And some of these folks were sad that they weren't able to talk to some of their elders before they passed away. All that information that they got, I mean, it's gone, you know. One friend of mine told me that she has her great-great-granddad's manumission papers from Jamaica. She has it original in her possession. And her great-great-granddad, you know, like Aladu Equiano, was able to document, you know, when he was captured and what went on the plantation. And I told her, that's a great movie. That's a great
Correct.
Movie. Mm-hmm. Thank you for today giving me this platform to further educate and enlighten the folks on people called the Maroons in Jamaica.
All right. This should be the beginning of a good relationship in terms of I'll try to help you spread the word about Akwuntu, the journey. Thank you very much.